Good evening and welcome to the Pacifica National Board Audit Committee meeting. My name is Nia Bediaco and I'm here with my wonderful colleagues of the committee. We, as of right now, we have not met quorum, but we thought we'll come to you with the discussion. Our night tonight would be short anyway because we're going to be interviewing off the stream anyway. But as usual, I always thank you very much for supporting the Pacifica Foundation and ask you to continue doing that. I'd like to also thank you for helping KPFT, WBAI, and KPFA for making their summer fun drive goals. Next week from 8:17 through 8:20 will be WPFW, and we ask those people in the listening area or even out of the listening area to continue support because, as I always say, without you, there is no us. I will call, we won't call the roll. I tell you what our proposed agenda is for tonight, which is first roll call and approval of agenda, approval of minutes, the next meeting date, a debriefing on the last in-person Pacifica National Board meeting, discussion about hiring Pacifica's auditor, then, of course, we will go off at 9:30 p.m. While we're here, we have the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer of Pacifica, and we have our controller, Ben Garcia, and I think we should go for setting the next meeting date. But I asked my colleagues on the audit committee, I would assume we need a dateline.
Yeah, Lonnie, we do.
We need a date in the near future.
That would be I'm in a week or so. I have the availability of the next interviewee that we're interviewing for the audit, mm-hmm. And his name is he's available Monday. Let me just get all of his availability dates, and here they are. He is available Monday and Thursday.
Okay, well, there is a PNB meeting. The Pacifica National Board of Racism and Sexism meets on Monday. Am I correct about that, Lisa?
Yes. Wednesday would also do in a pinch. So ruling Monday out, we have Thursday and Wednesday.
Okay. It would have to be Wednesday because on Thursday, that's the National Finance Committee meeting, Lonnie.
Yes.
Okay. How about the other people on the committee? Which are Ambrose Lane, Jack Van Aken, Joe Gonzalez.
You're talking next week?
Yes.
Yeah. Either date would be good.
Next Wednesday. How about the rest of the folks?
What time was that?
It would be at 8:30. Does everybody like 8:30?
Yeah.
8:30 Eastern?
He's saying that he can do it if the call is over by 6 p.m. Eastern. That's for Wednesday. The other day is not a problem. But I have an email from him saying he'd prefer if the call is over by 6 p.m. Eastern. I can call him and see if he can make himself available beyond that.
Well, that means that we could do him first and then stream after.
Okay.
Lisa, you trying to say something?
I was going
to
say Wednesday is not a good day for me. I'm stepping away for 5 seconds. I'll be right back.
So if we did him first at 5, we'd be done by 6.
Okay. We need quorum. See, that's the problem. And Lonnie, going into the next week will be too late, you think?
It's pushing it, but let's see what we have. That would be the week. Of the 27th. Wow. I can check his availability, but if we can find a date in the 27th, I'll check with him, and we at least would have a quorum.
Okay. I can do the 28th or the 28th. That's about all I can do that week. I can only do the 28th.
A Tuesday?
Yeah, other than that, everything else is tied up with local stuff for me.
Tuesday is okay with me.
How
anyone else?
How about the others?
That would be okay by me as well.
Yeah, 28th is all right.
Okay. Yeah, all
right. Okay, hearing no objection, the 28th? Okay. So, P&B audit. At what time? Do we say 8, 8:30 Eastern?
8:30 Eastern, I think.
8:30 Eastern. Okay, Lonnie, so try to see if he could come on.
Yeah, I'll
we'll
send him an email right now.
Yeah, give us a chance to get at least get quorum, and then we could stream after to accommodate him.
Okay.
All righty. Okay.
I've got a question. I'm about to be beginning a new job, which won't allow me to participate before 9:30 Eastern. And I'm afraid that that's going to cause trouble for everybody on the East Coast. But I don't know if is there any opinion as to what I should do. Is it appropriate for me to continue?
Could you come on for just a few minutes to make quorum, or then you could go back to your job? Sometimes I
really don't believe I will be able to, just because it's actually a peak time of day, and I'll probably be at that from in that little bit of period trying to deal with about 100 parents. So. And every day, so it's not even just a once in a while, but that's the normal. My normal routine will be extremely busy between 5 and 6 p.m. on weekday evenings.
Well, I normally like to end the meeting, as you guys realize, at 10:30. I figured 2 hours, if we do it efficiently, we should be able to accomplish. You certainly may come on. I am sensitive to people's situations. I don't see that as a problem. You come on at 9:30. Your input is valuable.
And of course, it's not that I will never be able to participate. It's just I can't promise. So.
Okay.
This is Jamie.
Okay, Jamie's on.
Yeah, sorry, I'm late.
Okay.
How are we doing?
Okay. Well, we are streaming live, and there are 7 of us on. We're just missing one more person for quorum. So we're just going to go ahead, Jamie. Welcome. If you'd like to start, are you ready with your pen and paper?
Yeah.
you came on pen in hand? Okay,
yep.
Great. We just set the next meeting date. If you want to, that's going to be August 28th at 8:30 p.m.
Okay.
All right. What time is it? Lonnie, just keep the time for me, please.
It's like 8:55.
I'll do it. It's 8:56 exact. Ready to go.
Okay, great. So, the fourth. Did everybody get the agenda now?
Yes.
Okay. We're just having an informal discussion since we don't have quorum. I think the most critical thing here is the discussion about hiring Pacifica's next auditor. So. Ben and Lonnie, Ben Garcia, the controller, and Lonnie Hicks, CFO, are here. And I think we should just discuss what is it that you are looking for in the auditor. And if anybody has any other questions, then we can certainly have them ready to ask Ross Wisdom, who will be on at 9:30 off stream to be interviewed. So, Lonnie, go ahead.
Well, Ben, jump on in anytime you'd like. But I think the first question is scope of the audit. You want to know what the auditor will, in fact, what the scope of the audit will entail. There is variability. Some auditors do wide scope. Some auditors do just sampling of various accounts. Some auditors don't really travel. They like you to have everything there available to them. So there are two things, scope of the audit, what schedules we have to provide to the auditor versus ones that they will include as a part of their audit price. So the first question is, what is the scope of the audit and what schedules, specific schedules, the auditor will do as opposed to ones we have to generate in-house. The second aspect of scope is going to be the methodology in terms of conducting the audit. You start with basically confirmations and audits to bank statements in cash. Many audits start that way. that's how they have verify whatever they may find in the GO. And that's standard, and most of them do that. So you want to know also the waivers in the audit engagement letter. That is to say, many auditors will basically tell you that they, in the process of conducting an audit, can guarantee one or all three of three possible outcomes. One outcome, what we call a light audit, is that the auditor is basically saying to you, I'm guaranteeing to you that the accuracy of these books are as verifiable as I can make them, and I have discovered what is called no material irregularities or inconsistencies. And material for an auditor is a basic definition. You want to know what the definition of materiality is. Some auditors say 5,000, 10,000, or 1% of revenue, 1% of expense. So you do want to know what the auditor's definition of materiality is in terms of discrepancies in the books. And then some auditors do full-scale audits. That is to say, they want to audit not only the books, and they do confirmations, meaning that they will send letters out to all of our vendors confirming the invoice numbers and that these accounts are real accounts and that they're real vendors out there and they aren't dummy vendors receiving false payments. And they also will audit two or three sides of a transaction. They'll verify the accounts at the stations level as well as the levels that may appear in the national office book. So they travel. They're doing that to verify two or three sides of accounts. Then they do sampling, which is to say they will sample. They're not going to go through every line item. They're going to go through a sample of payroll, a sample of the cash register, that is to say the check register, and they will sample those. If they find discrepancies, then they will, of course, bring that to the attention of staff and station personnel, national office personnel, and they'll want to know that there are items that show high variability, that is to say, if you spent $5 on $100 on premiums last year and all of a sudden you show $600 on premiums, for example, they will want to know why the variability is there. My definition of a good auditor, given all those, there are many others I can name, and we won't have time to go through them all, but my definition of an auditor is one who can give you all the costs involved in an audit. That is to say, not just the main audit, but will there be an extra charge for auditing stations? Will there be an extra charge for the 1099 audit? Will there be an extra charge, in our case, for the CPB audit? And the second big criteria is how many people are coming with the auditor. The more people, the more cost, and you end up billing for the travel of that auditor, the hotel stay, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to know all costs, and so you need to have a sense of what the whole audit will cost, not just add-ons, but you want to know the entire cost. And turnaround time. We are in a situation where we have really important deadlines for CPB. We have a February 15th deadline to get two CPB reports that are based on the audit. We have deadlines associated with grants that we may be seeking to solicit, and they will require an audit document. Banks will require the updated recent audit. So the audit document is an important document to have available in a timely way. Generally, the guideline is 120 days past the end of the fiscal. That is to say, our fiscal ends September 30th. Then we want an audit document, and also many other folks we vendors like the IRS and the state disability insurance, our pension auditors. We have about 8 audits during the year. This is merely one, the largest one, but we have other auditors as well who come through. So 120 days, and you want to be sure that the document will be finished and complete within that time frame. So those are the things: turnaround time, cost, full cost, and methodology and scope. Those are the four areas. And the last one I'll mention is the audit letter. Sometimes you want the auditor to do what's called an audit or management letter, in which the auditor is writing to management saying, this is not only what I found, And we generally do okay in our audits, but sometimes you'll ask the auditor to make recommendations about where improvement could occur on a low-cost basis. You can always make recommendations that are impossible to achieve because it costs too much. But he did last time for us. The last audit, Ross has been our auditor for at least 4 years. And he made some recommendations, out of which came our financial policies and procedures manual. We had done it back in 2003. The board and the finance committee had not really done the work of examining it. And the audit committee wasn't functional, but this time around, he's working with us in getting that financial policies and procedures manual done, and we thank him for that, along with all the people who worked on it, and everyone worked on that policies and procedures manual, the audit committee, the finance committee, business managers, general managers, my staff. So it is a lot of work in it, and we still have a little bit more to do, but it is now substantially have been moved forward. Deadline on that, we're hoping to get it through the board, have it on the board agenda for September 15th. But anyway, Ben, what have I left out? Ben conducts our audit. That is to say, he works directly with the auditor, and Ben is responsible for the GL and the books of both the stations and the national office. As CFO, I attend by practice and by common practice, you don't want two people in charge of the books. You want one person, so the accountability factor is always clear. So anyway, Ben, what do you have that you want to add to that?
Well, also, once the audit is complete, that allows me to do the CPB report for the financials for all the stations, which they require. The auditor also steps in at the end after I've completed those financials for each station, and he has to review those, look over the numbers that I put on the financials, and again, sign off on each CPB report for each station. So, you know, once he's completed his audit, I'm using the audited financial, he has to still step in afterwards and sign off as that he's looked at the figures for each station and that he signs off on each one. So that's very important in order for us to get the funding we need.
As auditor sign off, I want to add, is very serious. An auditor that will not sign off on your book will, in fact, make it very difficult to get the CPB funds and make it very difficult to work with certain vendors who want a signed-off audit. So the auditor has considerable clout in an organization where that person is doing the audit. So that would be it on sort of what to look for. Those four areas, scope, cost, full cost, methodology, and turnaround time, that is. Can you produce a timely audit that's accurate? And the management letter, which would be the fifth item that's on my list, at least, when talking to auditors.
I'll take a stack. Does anybody have any questions for Lonnie and Ben? I have a few questions, but I'll go after everyone to speak. Does anybody have a question?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Lonnie, if you could just touch a little bit more on when you say the scope of the audit, and I guess what that would encompass when you were talking about the scope and the schedules of the audit.
Oh, Lonnie, you want to go ahead?
Or anyone, not just Lonnie, or anyone who can answer that.
Anyone, yeah, go ahead. Ben, you want to go ahead?
Well, yeah, I mean, we begin with, like Lonnie said, with the confirmations and that process with the back reconciliations and the accounts payable, but then we get into the schedules of the different things like consultants, the schedules for the investments, those kind of schedules that we produce for the auditors, whereas before they used to produce them, but now we produce them in order to cut down the cost. And so, again, they're able to review monthly reports that we get, but we consolidate them into a spreadsheet kind of format. And so when we give them reconciliations, again, for the banks, the investments, any suspense accounts that we may have, receivables, those kind of things, being able to produce. We do, obviously, the accounts payable listing, but that comes from the Great Plains report, but they may do some formatting on that. Those kind of things. Again, those are the kind of schedules of functional expenses, making sure everything is in the right department, that kind of stuff. So it's basically, if you took all the balance sheet accounts and sort of produced a schedule of, kind of thing, that would sort of detail what was going on all the balance sheet accounts in a sort of spreadsheet format, so everything is detailed, not just a number, but a description of what is in this account.
Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about schedules pertaining to the auditor, we want to know how often they would be able to review this? Or...
I'm sorry,
when normally I think of the word scheduled, I think like timelines and stuff like that. So is when we are bringing up the issue of schedules with the auditor and including what you were just saying, are we also concerned with the timeline in which they can do these things, like how frequently or...
Well, we try to, the schedules per se, that's where beginning with the confirmation process and those kind of things at the beginning is we know what kind of schedules to give them, because we get monthly reports. Again, like say, for instance, the investments, we're able to produce those kind of schedules in the beginning, or the accounts payable. If we have all the input in, we can produce those kind of reports, give them to them so they can start working on them to do a sampling in order to do the confirmations. We know the bank account numbers. We do all bank accounts as far as the confirmations are concerned. So we have to make sure we have the bank, the address, the person who is a contact, and the confirmation form filled out in order for them to send out, because they have to send it out. We can't.
Oh, okay.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, this you're asking, how often does an auditor check back with us as a follow-on, maybe quarterly or what have you? Generally, they don't. Though we communicate with them every year, every month, on questions that come up around, in terms of what they may have found in the audit or questions we have around what's accepted procedure in accounting. So there's constant communication. I must say that Ross Wisdom does not charge us. We're on no meter during the year, and that's one of the things that's really good about him. He doesn't charge us for every time we pick up the phone with a question. The second question is, what are you getting when you get an audit document? What is being guaranteed? Well, it turns out that all auditors in the United States have been impacted by two or three serious changes in accounting practice over the last 15 years, at least that I'm aware of. One change is auditors have in their engagement letters more or less backed away from guaranteeing above material levels content of audits. What they have said is what we're guaranteeing here is that there's no material errors in what we examine. They're guaranteeing that that's the materiality question. They're also guaranteeing that policies and procedures in use are those normally required by accounting professionals. So they're guaranteeing that the procedures that the company, or in this case Pacific, is using are normal, are acceptable, and that they have found in examining the books no large-scale material discrepancies or inconsistencies. What they're not guaranteeing, and they backed away from, is they're not saying that there aren't as much as $5,000 or $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 somehow or other unaccounted for, or there's no receipts for them. But they don't consider that material in an organization our size. The materiality is related to your size in accounting. So we are, I don't know, an $18 million operation. So materiality might be $5,000 or something like that. And that doesn't mean it's there or not there. It just means that if they find it, they come across it, so they will bring it to our attention and ask us about it. But if they don't find anything like that, then they don't bring it up. If they do see a need for tightening up internal controls, or inputting new procedures, then they will do that, of course, and it will come out in the management letter. So that's sort of how it works. The timetable, I didn't mention that, but they like to have their engagement letters by August, because they are scheduling many firms, not just our firm, for site visits for audit. And that will happen. The first visit will be in October. We're trying to send to them all of the items that they'll need to review before they ever show up in October. So we're starting to send stuff toward the end of October, toward the end of August, the beginning of October. And then they come in October, and at that point, they have had time to look over some of the materials we've already sent. Ben, you want to pick it up right there? What happened?
Right. Yeah, well, I agree, Lonnie, because I think it's important that again, we look at what they do charge and we do call them during, you know, after the audit, and again, any questions that we may have. But they also must retain the information that they audited. And I think that's important because as they audit the books and they're familiar with what's going on with Pacifica, we were able to call them and say, well, here's the situation. What, you know, how can we handle it? And or even with the CPB, you know, they're done with the audit, and I'm producing the reports for the CPB, but they still the auditor still has to come back and say, okay, now let's go over the figures again. This is what we reported in the audit financial statements. So let's go back and look at the detail because, again, they still have to go back and sign off on that. And again, there is discussion. It's not just a matter of I've done the reports and the auditor comes in and signs off. No, we go back and forth sometimes and call and say, well, what is this that you put in here, or why did you take this out? Is it non-federal funding or, you know, this kind of thing. So we discuss. There's a lot of discussion there. So it's important that, again, that they become very familiar with Pacifica's books. And although it is difficult because, again, the person like Ross, for instance, has to look at the whole completed CPB report, but, again, he doesn't do all the audit. He does have people that work for him. So, again, but he is still familiar enough with what's going on at Pacifica in order to answer a lot of questions.
And are you done, Ben?
Yes.
Just for the audience's sake, how much per hour does Pacifica a lot for an auditor per hour?
We don't do audits hourly because that could get expensive. So sometimes audits take a shorter period of time, a longer period of time. We do flat rates, that is to say.
Okay.
We charge, we say we have this much to spend on this audit, and that's it.
Okay.
That's how we work it. And we also try to reduce the cost, that is how many hours they spend on the audit, by producing more and more of the work ourselves so that the auditor doesn't have to take it back and work on schedules by themselves. We try to produce as much of it as we can.
Right, lead sheets and things like that.
So if someone calls and he doesn't say, like, $20 an hour, $30 an hour, there isn't that cost.
No, we don't quite do it that way, but how many hours, Ben, do you think are in an audit?
God, you know, it's hard to say.
Our time and his time.
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of preliminary, and then we're very busy, of course, when they're here for the preliminary audit and then when they come back. But, you know, we try to get the schedules done and produce the lead sheets and do all the adjustments and have the books closed so that we know we're not holding them up. And that's the important thing, too, is that, you know, when they're ready to come out at the end to do the audit, that we have all of our final adjustments made that we need to make and that we've reconciled all of our accounts. And so when they step in, they have a complete package, so it, you know, they don't have to wait for us to try to complete things. Because, again, that would take time, their time, and our time, because we're, you know, running around doing things. So it's really hard to say how many hours it's.
I think
okay.
I do have a number. That audit takes between 120 and 150 hours working with three people. That is three people working on it for that period of time. And it'll work out to about $300 an hour with three people working on it is what when I ran some numbers on it last time I did this.
Okay.
So that's okay. The question, though, is how difficult is Pacifica's audit compared to other nonprofits? We are a 501c3. Well, we are, most nonprofits, the average budget is $500,000. That is the average budget of the average nonprofit in California. Of course, United Way and large nonprofits like that are exception, but we are in the 1% tile for in terms of size. Our budget is $18 million. So we're a large nonprofit for auditors to work with. They're used to working with smaller nonprofits, but we are large, and we're complicated, and we have 1,200 lines of accounts that we publish each month. So we're a handful for a auditor used to working with nonprofits. We're large
in more ways than one, right?
Yeah.
another thing is
if only you really knew.
The Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, that affected media for those people who don't know what that is, and it's about the allegations of media reports of major charities and some improprieties with charitable community. Are we aware of that, Lonnie, and that's taken into effect?
We've had discussions about it. Sarbanes-Oxley was passed in the wake of the Enron scandal.
Right, right.
And it's designed to, what happened in Enron, and I won't go into any great detail, is that the CEO and the chief financial officer, the CEO's defense was, I didn't know what was going on. And the chief financial officer said, yes, that person did know what was going on. So Sarbanes-Oxley, in the for-profit world, it's clear that the CFO and the CEO or ED must sign off and verify the veracity and the integrity of all accounting documents, and certainly in the audit as well. Remember, it's no longer the accounting. The auditor comes in, and they look, and they try to find issues. But in the end, it's an accountability issue. Who's accountable for the book? Well, it turns out, under Sarbanes-Oxley in the for-profit world, it is the CEO and the CFO. Now, how does that affect nonprofits? Remember, it was done for for-profits. The nonprofit world and some auditors as well are saying, well, we should aspire to those guidelines and standards that apply in Sarbanes-Oxley. So we sort of, I take the attitude that I am the chief financial officer. I am willing to be responsible for the condition of Pacifica's books. So we sort of practice that, even though it is not clear that nonprofits are strictly required to adhere to Sarbanes. So that's where it sits. There's another California law that also applied. I think it came into effect January 1, 2005, or was it 2006? But anyway, it said that finance staff should not, in fact, serve on the audit committee, although the combined committees could meet to exchange information. We haven't really, we by and large keep the two committees separate, but they have, as
right.
you know, had joint meetings to share information and to work on, in this case, the financial policy, which affects both committees. So that's sort of the two laws that I'm aware of that have recently had somewhat of an impact on how we do business.
Okay, and I think we're close to 9:30, but I just have another question. Like, I know some auditors will give an opinion on the management of a foundation. Is this something that a Pacifica auditor does?
Some do, but they do consider it separately from giving an opinion on GAAP-related procedures, how well are the internal controls established, implemented, and monitored. And they do give an opinion on the state of the books, the GL trial balances. They balance or they don't balance. But giving a management opinion is moving over into that consulting area. And some auditors are not comfortable because, again, of Enron, where if your auditor ends up being a consultant, some people consider that too close to management. And that's what happened in Enron, at least some people think so. So they tend not to want to do an opinion on the management skills of management, but they like to stick strictly to the accounting. It is.
Do they ask questions? Do they couch them in the form of questions about the
They can ask management what the procedures are, what do you do, how do you handle this. And they can do all that. But that line between being the auditor and being a consultant to management or evaluating management is sometimes auditors don't want to cross that line. It's a gray area.
Okay. Well, I think it's I think it's 9:30 about. So does anybody have anything else that he or she would like to say before we say goodbye to our audience?
Yeah, okay. This is Jamie.
Yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
I have one question about the definition of what's a material discrepancy. How would you define that in terms of Pacifica's budget? Like if we're a $19 or $18 million operation, what would material be in our case?
Well, that's a good question for the audit when we do the interview. But they have a formula that they use, and what's our material number, Ben? I thought it was like. You remember, you have it off the top of your head. I have a number, but I'm not sure it's right.
I was thinking it was 5.2, but I think it probably depends on what area we're looking at. Because, again, each station, I think he does look at each station. And again, we have a large budget consolidated-wise, but then each station is, you know, we do look at each station as if you want to call it its own entity, and see what the receipts are, what the expenses are, and that kind of thing. So So if you know, I think they can't help but look at something. Say, for instance, one of the smaller stations, and look at something that may be more material there than they would be someplace else.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I have one quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I understood correctly, this would be the fourth audit that Ross Wisdom has already completed, or this would be the
at least four, maybe five.
Yeah.
Okay. And so my question is that where we are in terms of the overall situation of, you know, I know that it's good to work with the same people because, you know, they don't have to catch up to speed, but then with auditing, at a certain point, you should maybe change because you want to have a fresh point of view, and I don't know where we are in that overall picture.
Well, you do. Sometimes the organizations do that. And Pacifica has looked at it in the past, but you remember this auditor was there during the take-back period, and he's been around and knows Pacifica's history and accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that does recommend him, at least, is we're trying to get the pension scenario straight going back to 01, and he can help us with that. So we are, in a way, still working with him on straightening out the accounting from that period, and remember that the accounting was not done very well in this period, 01, 02, and 03. We came on board as an accounting team only in 03, and we're still needing to work with this auditor around, because he was here when we were not, so he's helping us get
okay.
with it. That's
well, I mean, can I add to that also, again, it is a thing, too, of money, because when you get a new auditor and you're teaching their new people. And what happens sometimes with new auditors, they will send in a new team, not only because they're new to Pacifica, but they're new to that firm. And so what happens is we're training their people, what I found in the past, other companies I work with. And again, it costs us more because they're spending more hours there, more time there. And with an auditor that knows Pacifica, that knows what's going on in our chart of accounts, knows the stations, knows, you know, that kind of thing. It makes it so much easier. That's all.
Anyway.
Okay. So there are no term limits, right?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I don't think that based upon because an auditor is familiar with the company, I think maybe companies may look at it and say, well, do we want to change auditors because we're trying to cut the cost or something? But I don't know if they're looking to say, well, let's change auditors because we don't want them to be too familiar or...
Do we look at political sensitivity and sensitivity towards the mission? Do we look at things like that?
Yeah, very interesting question. Very interesting question because an auditor at Pacifica has to be aware that anything he or she says can be amplified and exaggerated and used by factions. And Ross has been excellent in that area. He's managed not to become a factor in the internal politics of Pacifica, and that's a very, very, very important skill. That is, auditor keeping distance from political politics. He's good at it. He's very good at it. Some auditors are not. They don't understand that whatever they say can have enormous ramifications, and you can spend a whole year explaining what an auditor might have thought of as just an offhand comment. But Ross is good at it. And remember, he... comes to the audit meeting of the January board, and he handles direct questions from board members around the audit. So you can see, you know, that's a skill, being able to present an audit and be able to present it at a board meeting and answer questions, and sometimes for a fractionated board scenario. So that's something
yeah.
that is.
I think
he's exceptional.
Yeah, well, I think to add to that is that I think he's more than once offered to talk to, you know, the audit committee whenever they had questions or wanted to explain something.
Somebody's echoing. Yeah. Okay, we'll try to work through this. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Alisa?
I was just going to
ask. Are you done, Ben?
Yes.
Ben? Okay.
Yes.
I was just going to ask one more quick question, especially
sure.
since I'm relatively new to the audit committee. How frequently do we go for interviewing auditors? How often does that happen usually? Will we enter into like a contract with them for like a year or so, or how does that work?
You mean in terms of the interview process, looking for new auditors, you mean?
Yeah. How often do we go out for interviews for them?
Well, when the audit committee wasn't functioning, we didn't do it. But as the audit committee now comes to function, we should do it every year. So this will be the first year where the audit committee has been able to meet and been able to entertain the interview process. So, and, of course, I expect that it will happen next year as well.
Okay, that's it? Okay. Lonnie, while we're live, I'd just like to mention this before we do the interview. It's in terms of the policies and procedures manual, I had forgotten to include in there, like, vacation for staff. So I think we need to in terms of tracking people's vacation, time off in general, is that something that should be in the policies and procedures manual?
Absolutely, it should, yeah.
Okay. Well, we forgot that. Now, is there a system in place? How do you monitor that?
Actually, it's a policy that also has to be in our personnel policy. Mm-hmm. So you have two documents. One would be, of course, these policies and procedures manual, but also would be something to be added to our personnel policies, which need to be updated as well. And we did an update, but the board has never acted on the policies and procedures manual or the personnel manual. And I think those are the two places that we need to ensure that that procedure is included in those documents. So I would say the answer is yes. I think we need to do it in policies and procedures anyway now, but there needs to be a follow-on with the other items and personnel.
And what's the next step? Now that we've gone through that, the audit committee, we would meet and discuss that in terms of adding something. Does the board have to approve the policies and procedures manual that we went through? Where does it go from here?
The intent was to introduce them at, I'm bringing them to finance committee on the 23rd. They have seen it. This committee has seen it. We want to add the policy you suggest to it. And then my plan was to have the Finance Committee, which has reviewed it, at least some folks on finance have, and have it be sent forward to the board for the September board. And the board may at that point feel they might need another 2 or 3 months to review it, having not seen it in its entirety. But we will have done our job, which would be to place it before the board for its review. So that would be what I sort of had in my head. I don't know if that works for you folks, but it will be a joint. It would be the joint work of audit, finance, and the finance staff. We'd let everybody know that we did all at least review it so the board could understand it was a group document. So.
Okay. And you've incorporated Ross's suggestion in that sort of final version, correct?
Yes, yes. He did make comments. He certainly did.
Okay, great. All righty. Thank you so much. So if no one has any further questions, I'd like to thank our listeners and supporters, and we will be tuning out from you, but our work is not done. And again, I thank you for your continued support, and we will see you on August 28th at 8:30 p.m. John, thank you.
Okay.
But we will stay on. And Lonnie, could you call Ross?
I will call him right now. Let me go on mute for a second.
I'm going to be muted for a moment.
Okay. And John, we're off the stream?